got the list. Okay, so it is December 29th, 2018. It is the last Shabbat of this year. Next week we start 2019. And we also start Deuteronomy next week. But we must finish Numbers. So we are looking at Numbers 35, verse 9 through 36, which the last verse of Numbers is verse 13. Numbers 36, verse 13. And the Haftarah is Joshua 20, starting in verse 1 and the following verses. So, dear Lord, thank you for bringing us here this morning. Thank you for those who have come in the rain, those who have come with broken bones, broken lives, and bad backs, and whatever else is ailing us here this morning, whatever challenges that we're involved with. We just ask that you would show up here, be with us in a real and a tangible way in our lives, in our relationships. Help us to look beyond ourselves, to see you in each person here, and people that we meet on the streets and in our lives, that we can truly enter your kingdom on a daily basis. Fill our breath now, our hearts, our souls, with your life, your spirit. In your name we pray, Jesus. Amen.
Amen.
So, good morning, everyone. We're going to start by reading Numbers 35 and verse 9. And I guess we shall go with our normal pattern here on the right side. Then the Lord spoke to Moses.
Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, Speak to the children of Israel, and say to them, When you cross the Jordan into the land of Canaan, then you shall appoint cities to be cities of refuge for you, that the manslayer who kills any person accidentally may flee there. They should be cities of refuge for you from the avenger, that the manslayer may not die until he stands before the congregation in judgment. And of the cities which you give, you shall have six cities of refuge. You shall appoint three cities on this side of the Jordan, and three cities you shall appoint in the land of Canaan, which will be cities of refuge. These six cities shall be refuge for the children of Israel, for the stranger, for the sojourner among them, that anyone who kills a person accidentally may flee there.
But if he hits someone with an iron tool so that he dies, he is a murderer. The murderer must surely be put to death. If he strikes him by throwing a stone large enough that he could die, and he dies, he is a murderer. The murderer must surely be put to death. Or if he strikes him with a wooden hand weapon so that he could die, and he dies, he is a murderer. The murderer must surely be put to death. The avenger of blood himself must kill the murderer. When he meets him, he must kill him. Verse 20.
If he pushes him out of hatred or while lying in wait, hurls something at him so that he dies. Did I go to 21?
You just keep reading a chunk so it makes sense.
Okay. If he pushes him out of, 21. Or if enmity, he strikes him with his hand so that he dies, the one who struck him shall surely be put to death. He is a murderer. The avenger of blood shall put the murderer to death when he meets him. 22. However, if he pushes him suddenly without enmity or throws anything at him without lying in wait, uses a stone by which a man could die, throwing it at him without seeing him, so that he dies while he was not his enemy or seeking his harm. Then the congregation shall judge between the manslayer and the avenger of blood according to these judgments.
The assembly must protect the one accused of murder from the avenger of blood and send the accused back to the city of refuge to which they fled. The accused must stay there until the death of the high priest who was anointed with the holy oil. But if the accused ever goes outside the limits of the city of refuge to which they fled and the avenger of blood finds him outside the city, the avenger of blood may kill the accused without being guilty of murder. The accused must stay in the city of refuge until the death of the high priest. Only after the death of the high priest may they return to their own property.
Verse 29?
Yeah.
So these things shall be for a statue of judgment unto you throughout your generations and all your dwellings. Whoever killeth any person, the murderer shall be put to death by the mouth of witnesses, but one witness shall not testify against any person to cause him to die. Moreover, ye shall take no satisfaction in the life of a murderer, which is guilty of death, but he shall be surely put to death. And ye shall take no satisfaction for him that is fled to the city of his refuge, that he should come again to dwell in the land until the death of the priest. So ye shall not pollute the land wherein ye are, for blood, it defileth the land, and the land cannot be cleansed of the blood that is shed therein, but by the blood of him that shed it. Defile not, therefore, the land which ye shall inhabit, wherein I dwell, for I, the Lord, dwell among the children of Israel.
Okay, so I'm going to stop it there. That's the end of chapter 35. And this morning, because we don't have a lot of time, I'm not going to read 36. Because if you turn to the Haftarah, which is Joshua 20, the focus this morning is on what we just read in Numbers 35. Would you be interested in reading Joshua 20?
Oh, Joshua 20. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. What verse?
First one.
Then the Lord said to Joshua, tell the Israelites to designate the cities of refuge as I instructed you through Moses, so that anyone who kills a person accidentally and unintentionally may flee there and find protection from the avenger of blood. When he flees to one of these cities, he is to stand in the entrance of the city gate and state his case before the elders of that city. Then they are to admit him into their city and give him a place to live with them. If the avenger of blood pursues him, they must not surrender the one accused because he killed his neighbor unintentionally and without malice aforethought. He is to stay in that city until he has stood trial before the assembly and until the death of the high priest who is serving at that time. Then he may go back to his own home in the town from which he fled. So they set apart Kedesh in Galilee in the hill country of Naphtali, Shechem in the hill country of Ephraim, and Kiriath Arba, that is Hebron, in the hill country of Judah. On the east side of the Jordan of Jericho, they designated Beza in the desert on the plateau in the tribe of Reuben, Ramoth in Gilead, in the tribe of Gad, and Golan in Bashan, in the tribe of Manasseh. Any of the Israelites or any alien living among them who killed someone accidentally could flee to these designated cities and not be killed by the avenger of blood prior to standing trial before the assembly.
Okay, great. Thank you. So, here we go. What are we talking about this morning?
Cities of refuge.
Cities of refuge. Yes. Okay, in Hebrew, it's areli miklat. What do we say today in modern Hebrew? What's a miklat?
Bomb shelter.
It's a bomb shelter. Because why do we go to a bomb shelter?
Safety.
For safety. Because
someone's sending missiles.
Theoretically, you're about ready to be killed, and it's going to protect you from the missile. And we have, actually there's three parties involved in this scenario.
You're talking right now in numbers, not Joshua.
Well, I'm mixing the three.
You're mixing.
Sorry, the two.
What's the word again for a city of refuge in Hebrew? Something like that.
Miklat, because it's talking about how many of these cities?
Six.
Okay, we first start off with back in Numbers 35, which we didn't read. It was in verse 7 or 6 last times. It talks about Levitical cities, right? The cities of the Levites. Because Levites don't have an inheritance. They don't have land, right? But they are given cities. And how many cities are they given?
Six.
48.
Oh, 48.
If you look in Numbers 35, verse 6. If anybody sees it there.
48 is a good number?
No, right.
Multiple of 12?
42. Oh, yeah. 48. Yeah,
which
48.
Verse is it?
48, 7. In all you missed.
Verse 7.
Yeah.
Okay.
7.
So, Numbers 35, verse 7, it says that the Levites will have 48 cities.
Yeah.
And from these, and these cities are divided up among all the 12 tribes based off of how large the tribes are. So, if you're a large tribe, you have more Levitical cities. And if you don't have as much land and area or people, you have less Levitical cities. But that's not so important today. What we did know from this is there are six that are called these cities of refuge.
Oh, but are those six included in the Levitical?
Yes.
So
if you look in verse 6.
So for every eight cities, you have one city of refuge.
Numbers 35, verse 6. Six of the towns you give the Levites will be cities of refuge, to which a person who has killed someone may flee. In addition, give them 42 other towns. So in total, 48, but six are cities of refuge. Okay.
What's the reference again before? Which
Numbers 35, verse 6 and 7.
And that tells you as well about the 4
cities. How many? Yes, how many? Okay. That's right before our parasha.
Okay. Now, quickly, what are we talking about here? What is this refuge from?
Being killed.
Being killed for doing what?
Unintentional.
Yes. So this is not just an amnesty place for anything. You had to have done something accidentally. You had to have murdered accidentally. Is that clear?
Yeah.
But in that time, accidentally killing other people is not allowed.
In cultures around the world, revenge is common. It's, yes, that you kill people because they killed your brother or your cousin. And it's acceptable. And it's, yeah.
Acceptable. You're right.
Yeah, in our goals, it's still acceptable.
Yes. It's still, and it's
so not supposed to carry out the revenge against.
Yes. Right. This now it does again, it's basically saying you can have revenge if it was done with malice, if it was done on purpose. But these cities of refuge are saying you can't have revenge for an accident. This specific
people.
As long as you stay in the city, but as soon as you come running out, because you get bored waiting for the high priest to die, you're up for
grabs.
Yes.
Because that's what happens even in many societies today, like in the Arab world, you're allowed to take revenge, and people say, well, we can take revenge from anyone from that family.
Yes.
Even if that family member had nothing to do with the murder. And it's like a cousin or a distant relative. He gets murdered, and then that person's brother said, what? My brother had nothing to do with that murder. And he gets angry, he wants to murder his son. And it goes on, and hundreds of years later, no one even remembers what it was about.
But that is even earlier.
Yeah.
Okay, so there's three parties in this scenario. There is the Rotseach. This is the murderer. There is the Goel Hadam. This is the Avenger. We have in English. So if you think about the comic books today, Marvel, but anyways, Avenger. And then we have the elders of the city of refuge. And what? It's interesting. So just a little background here. Rotseach, murderer here, is in the Ten Commandments. It says, do not murder. This is the word here. Lo nirtzach. It's not just do not kill. It means do not murder, like a human life on purpose. Goel Hadam. This is the word that we get for avenger or for in the story of Ruth. We're talking about Boaz. It says he is the redeemer, the kinsman redeemer. This is the same word, goel. Not with the blood part. Dam is, really the translation should be blood avenger.
Yeah.
But it's all a part of this idea that in your tribe or in your clan or in your family, you have this kind of godfather who basically takes care of the people that are blood related. And so if someone loses their inheritance, or someone sold into slavery, or someone is in debt, this is the person they come to fix the situation. So it's a person of power, and it's kind of, it's a responsibility, essentially. So this is this person who's come now to avenge the death of someone from their clan. And then the elders of the city, right, how do they play a part in our scenario here, what we've read? Right. They you come to the gates of the city and they're there to meet you, and they listen to your story and see if it's believable or if it's really legitimate as an accident. And they are the ones that let you in. So, okay, so we got this part. Now, yes.
Amy, this number 48:6, this number, do they have any specific meaning? Why it is not a 50? Why it is not a 10?
Yeah, I got it.
So no special.
As far as I know, I mean, you can always break it down.
Breaks down into 12.
There's 12 tribes.
Okay. So it is not related to the jury or whatever.
No.
Okay.
Yeah. There is one other thing here. We learn in Joshua about these six cities. What are the six cities and where are they? Mm-hmm. They're east and west.
This is
the Jordan River. Mm-hmm. Okay, so what are the three here on the side of Israel? Canaan.
Hebron is one.
Hebron or Kiryat Arba.
Kedesh,
Hebron. Okay, so on your map here, you kind of have the whole place kind of divided up here. Kadesh is up here. It's north of Tzfat. It's below Kiryat Shmona. Here on the border with Lebanon. Then you have Shechem, right? Shechem, it's in the middle here.
Nablus today.
Nablus today. And Hebron, or Kiryat Arba. Those are the three on the west side. On the east side,
Betzer.
Ramot and Golan, right?
Golan.
So Golan's going to be obviously near the Golan. And I actually didn't check all these ones out, but I think Ramot is in here.
Ramot is Amman.
It's Amman. Okay. Yeah. So the capital of Jordan.
Amman.
Okay. So let's be specific here. What is an accidental murder? What does the text tell us in Numbers 35, 22, and 23?
If someone drops a stone accidentally.
Well, there's two things. You can look at the weapon they use.
Yes.
Or you can look at whether they were enemies before.
Their motivation.
Yeah, motivation.
But in 22, 23, it gives you a specific thing.
If you drop a stone on someone.
Well, it says 22, it says if you push him suddenly without enmity. I mean,
drop a stone.
But the idea is kind of like, it's like, you know, like all of a sudden, it's like a knee-jerk reaction where it wasn't done on purpose, but... Like you had a gun and you pulled, I don't know, a trigger and it went off in your hand or something.
You push him suddenly. I mean, you may be having a bit of a thing, but come on, how could you believe this? And you give him a push and he falls down and hits his head on
like,
the
like, yeah, like you're playing a game maybe. Yeah, or And they use this word here for hunt or like when you're trying to trap an animal that it's not... like you're setting a snare or you're trying below tzadia.
Is that seeking his harm here?
I think here they translate it, yes, in the 22. They don't really translate it in mine.
That's like
lying in wait.
That's lying in wait gets translated.
Yeah, that's
in the 23.
You're not seeking his harm.
Not seeking his harm.
Really a lot of this is about either motivation or about if you're playing with a dangerous object that you shouldn't be, something that could actually kill someone. So the examples they give are iron, stone, a wooden object.
A wooden object,
so like any good law, what makes somebody a good judge is they have to have wise interpretation. Because you could look at all of these and you could kind of be like, well, this is, I could see this or I could see this. And you've always got to use discernment when you wield the law. Because the law is, it's a blunt instrument. It can kill people if it's done the wrong way. But it also can, it's like a sword can kill someone. But the same concept of cutting someone is also what a surgeon uses to heal someone, to you know, with their instruments. It's how you use it.
So verse 16, 17, and 18 describe the weapon. If they use this weapon, it means they're a murderer. But then you see in verse 23, okay, so let's say you're using a stone that could be a murder weapon, but you didn't intend it.
The motivation.
Now it's not a murder.
Right, so
it's like,
there's this...
So verse 23 comes to qualify verse 17 to make sure, like you were saying, that someone doesn't use
the law against someone. Yeah.
It really is an incredible example of the law, even as we know it today, in action. You know, they say the law's an ass, but the law is fixed and it needs this extraordinary wisdom.
Did he have a motivation? What? I mean, the first question they ask is, why does X get killed? You know.
I think we should. I'm wondering if we should take him to 24. Yeah. So 24, the regulation you mentioned is actually a procedure. Is that true?
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
So in that case, in that case, when people have the arguing or something, then it should go through the procedure. But I'm not sure if here is mentioned to the due process or that kind of more, even more than term. I'm not sure.
I mean, it's one of these things where it's not completely clear, and we have to kind of read it and try to understand what was going on.
No. The in that time, the scenario is in this kind of case, it's clear. Yeah, in that case, it's clear. But in between, then it says the assembly must judge. Assembly judge. Just like a jury judge,
Of course.
No, I'm not sure.
No, what I'm saying here is what's important about this scenario that we're getting to is someone died. That's the most important thing here. Someone died. It could have been an accident, or it could have been intentional murder.
Yeah.
But you still can't change the fact that someone's dead. And so.
But what he's saying is there was a process.
I know.
Compared to the normal tribal law, like we were talking in Abu Ghosh, you can just go straight and kill someone then. Like, this is preventing that. You can't just, like, there is a way to make sure that people are protected if they did it by accident.
Right.
There's a process.
And one of the best things about process, it almost, no matter what the process is, it cools everything down. Slows everything down.
Right, so you don't rashly go and
kill
someone out of anger.
Yeah, and it allows people to surrender their emotions to a system, and there's something that justice in that.
So, like, for instance, in Arab society, when that murder happens and they try to prevent the blood vengeance, how do they deal with it?
Yes, you go to negotiation, and then
ultimately
you pay money.
You pay cash,
right? And that money is never enough. Mm-hmm. It's never good enough. There's never justice. But you, the point is that you say, okay, we stop. It ends here.
Okay, so look here in verse 31, Numbers 35:31. What does it say there?
Do not accept a ransom for the life of a
murderer.
He deserves to die. He must surely be put to death.
So this is my argument this morning, is that we could, I mean, there's a lot of things you could say, well, this is a way that you keep vengeance from spiraling out of control by doing this, or this is how you decide who's innocent and who's guilty, or, you know, how to come up with good justice. But I would argue that what's most important here in the text this morning is that the death of any human being is what matters. Even if it's an accident, it's still a death. It's still a loss of a life.
Yeah.
And so my question is, why? What does Numbers 35 tell us about why this is a bad thing at the end of the chapter?
35?
What does it say?
Yeah.
Yes, Numbers 35.
The Lord defiles the land.
Mm-hmm.
I am the Lord who dwells among the children of Israel.
Numbers 35:33. You must not pollute the land where you live, for blood defiles the land, and the land cannot be cleansed of the blood that is shed there, except by the blood of the person who shed it. Therefore, do not defile the land that you inhabit. So here's my question. Where do we get our first example of this in the Bible, of blood defiling the land? Okay, before Genesis 9?
Of Cain and Abel?
Yes, Cain and Abel.
But the whole play with the pouring out blood.
Okay, hold on, we'll get to Genesis 9. What happens in Genesis 4 with Cain and Abel? Genesis 4.
Moment. Here, when you say, when you go quickly,
sure.
Yeah, I just want to make clear. So, in 30, we are talking about 33 process, protection. And then we are talking about 31, and then 33. Now, the 30, especially 31 and 33,
right.
Then does it mean that the Bible against the idea of abolishing death penalty?
Of what?
Abolishing.
Abolishing the death penalty?
The death penalty? I'm not sure.
Yeah, no. Yeah, no, it doesn't say abolish the death penalty.
Because according to the 31, and especially 33, it says that if you kill other people, then that guy intentionally, right?
Yeah.
That guy should be killed.
Yes.
And then to purify that guy.
Yeah.
It seems to me it insisted on death penalty. So I'm not sure.
Except it says until the death of the high priest. And the high priest himself did not kill someone. So in the case of accidents, when the high priest, in Hebrews verse 32.
Wait, Sharon, let's hold on to the high priest yet.
I'm just saying, in terms of death penalty, when the high priest dies, he's covering the penalty of someone else. It's not his own penalty.
And so I'm trying.
So there is an exception for death penalties.
Yes.
What
do you want to say?
I'm getting into more like what he's saying. Let's think about the things now. We understand all. I'm a Levite. I wanted to know where the Levite should exist. I know that. When we had terrorism, the blood cried out from all these terrorists, killing of the blood on French Hill, a certain place where the soldiers always stood. But you have to go there. We are the priests now. You, Jen, Jenna, and you together, we are the priests, and we call out the blood to avenge is Yeshua's covenant.
And
so we went to the places.
Okay, but before we go there, though.
Pray for the area where the blood is calling out for more blood.
But
that's why the soldiers keep getting killed on that spot.
Before we go to the day, though, I want to stick with, I haven't gotten out of the Bible yet, with Genesis 4, I just want to build up to the context of what we're talking about, why the blood is so important. And in today's society, it's a little strange, but in the ancient biblical society, it's super important. Genesis 4, yes, Genesis 4, the first book. Okay, so in Genesis 4, Cain kills Abel, and then what does God tell Cain?
What have you done?
He said, "Yeah, right, what have you done?" But specifically with the blood.
The voice of the bloods of your brother.
Anything else? Next verse.
You are cursed from the ground.
Okay, does this sound familiar to Numbers 35? What did Numbers 35 say about the ground and blood?
Yes, defiled.
The ground, the land is defiled by the blood that is shed. And then, Sharon, you brought up Genesis 9. You want to go there? Genesis 9. Noah. After the flood, he comes out of the ark, and you want to just read that? Verse 4, I think.
Well, from verse 4. Okay.
I mean, you can give the context.
But you must not eat meat with its life, that is, its blood in it. For your lifeblood, I will surely exact punishment. From every living creature, I will exact punishment. From each person, I will exact punishment for the life of the individual. Since the man was his relative. Whoever sheds human blood, by other humans must his blood be shed. For in God's image, God has made humankind.
Okay, so this sounds like Numbers 35, verse 31, where it says, if someone had shed the blood, then that man's blood must be shed, right? We just read in Numbers 35.
The interesting thing is here, it just says, if you shed a human's blood, another human needs to shed your blood.
Right.
Numbers 35, not just another human, the one.
The God that done.
The one who actually shed the blood, his blood needs to be shed.
So what are you saying?
It's more specific.
Here it's any human.
The blood, once you shed a human's blood, that is only atoned for by the one who shed it.
Okay.
And here it's just, if you shed another person's blood, a person is going to shed your blood.
Right.
General.
Okay, but why? What is the justification of Genesis 9 for the shedding of the blood? Like, why are you not supposed to shed a human's blood? Okay, so, and that comes from what?
Genesis 1.
Right? In the creation, God said, I am making man and woman in my image, in the likeness of God, in the image of God. And Genesis 9, that's why you don't kill other humans, with an intention to murder. Because, and by the way, we're not talking here about war, because the Bible, when it talks about war and it talks about things involving, this is specifically more like between people and relationships. So now we've got this blood
and
issue.
Also here in Genesis, it's the animals too.
Yeah, but let's keep it with humans for right now, because we're specifically talking about humans are made in the image of God. Okay. Now, go back to Numbers 35. Okay. Now, let's say someone comes over and says, I saw so-and-so kill this person. Can they then be convicted for murder?
No, it's got to be more than one.
Okay, what is it, where does it say that?
Verse 30, but no one is to be put to death on the testimony of only one witness.
Okay, so you need witnesses. You need a plural agreement on who murdered who.
And you need two witnesses, it says something.
And you need, right, in other parts, it might be in Deuteronomy, it talks about two or three witnesses. Okay.
One important, I think it is an important point, is in the Bible, it refers to the blood, not refers to the injury or life or whatever.
Yes.
Whatever others. So
very good.
I think it is important.
Very good point. In the ancient Near East,
yeah.
You, like Babylon, Assyria, other cultures at that time, if you slapped someone and you were maybe a rich person being slapped by a poor person, they could kill you by the law. The law was very
class-based.
It was biased. Same thing with a slave. If a slave did something, it was very class-based.
So because of the bar, so it will exclude the possibility of the goods, property. So which means that if someone's property was stolen or whatever,
you can't kill them.
Yes. That is the exclusion. So I think
The Bible has this principle.
Do you think that the Bible is intentionally
The Bible has this principle in it, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, et cetera, et cetera. Often when we hear it today, we have this, this is a terrible concept, an eye for an eye. That means it's like revenge. No, it's actually saying the opposite. It's saying whatever's been done, you can only be punished accordingly. You can't be over punished.
Whether you're a slave or a rich man, an eye is any eye has the value of any other eye.
Yeah.
Any person has the value of another person because they're all in God's image.
And so in a sense, this is a radical concept of law and justice in the ancient world. Today when we read the Bible, people think, this is a little primitive and blah, blah, blah. But back then, it was on the cutting edge and of human rights in a lot of ways. What we call human rights today. Okay, so here's where I want to come to now. I want to come to what Sharon was saying about the high priest.
Before you go,
yes.
Can I just point out one thing I noticed?
Yes.
In Genesis and the story of Cain and Abel, when you the consequence of this polluting of the land. When you till the ground, it shall no longer yield its strength to you. And there was something about the effect of polluting the land in this way with a human blood somehow destroys its productivity, it destroys its fruitfulness, it destroys...
Just like the first sin also did that.
It's
if you read throughout the Old Testament, the Tanakh, the Hebrew scriptures, you'll read these stories about where people were killed and the land has been polluted until there is justice for that blood that was shed. And so it's part of the whole story of
the Bible. The idea of
the Bible.
Land throwing up the people.
Yes,
like
vomiting.
Vomiting. It's getting rid of the poisons inside, like the pollution of badness.
Why is it bad to kill a person, to murder a person?
Because he has made an image of God.
So what does that mean? It's as if
you killed God.
As if you killed God.
Right.
And and again, this we're talking about someone. It's like a premeditated murder, a murder with intention. This is not an accident. But even when it is an accident, there's still that problem that blood has been shed. And so this, Sharon, you want to bring your point in now with the high priest.
Okay, so the high priest, when he dies...
Where is that?
Numbers
35.
Verse 32.
Is that correct?
No, it's
also
28. Yeah,
yeah.
Both.
28 as well.
Yeah, it's both.
It's
Numbers 35, 28, and verse 32.
Okay.
Talk about till the death of the high priest.
Yeah, but after the death of the high priest, the slayer may return to the land of his possessions. So that's in the case that the slayer did it by accident.
Yeah.
So therefore, his blood doesn't have to be shed, but somebody's blood is shed. And it's the high priest. The high priest's blood covers his.
Because here's the funny thing. Is everybody listening to this? Because this is crucial. We often think, oh, if I accidentally killed someone, then I'm free to go once I go to court. It was an accident. But according to the Bible, no, you are basically exiled to the city for the rest of your life, even though it was an accident, until that high priest dies. When that high priest dies, then you're free. So what does that mean? Even in an accident, when blood is shed, what does that mean?
You're somehow guilty.
No, but blood also has to be shed. I've never seen that.
Yes.
I wondered why. What was the point of waiting until the high priest died?
I
never thought of that. But blood still had to be shed.
Yeah.
And because it was innocent, it was the high priest who was going to die anyway.
And we're using blood as a metaphor here because when the high priest dies, he can die in his bed. It's not that you go slit his throat. So blood shed is actually just that the person dies.
Yeah, that's
it. Bloodshed is an idiom. It's an idiom for death.
Here, high priest means that he died for that person.
Old age.
Yes. Old age or sickness.
Yeah, but he died for that person.
But
when he dies, his death
covers.
He didn't specifically die for that person. He died anyway.
But his blood covered
it. I mean, he died.
So it makes sense of any Christian doctrine, which says that Yeshua has to die, and his blood deals with our sin and gives us new life.
I've never seen that. Usually, we all say that Jesus died for us.
Jesus.
But now, according to this,
so watch this.
Everything in the Hebrew scripture is like a pattern or an example for the New Testament.
Okay.
Most Christians don't understand. We easily talk about Jesus died, he shed his blood for you. What the blazes does that mean? You know, it means nothing unless you can understand
where it comes from.
Where it comes from and what the principle is. It's wonderful.
Yeah. So watch this. We talk about these as cities of refuge,
cities, principally when we say refuge, means protection. It's a place you can go in and you're protected. But there's this, and in the Hebrew, that's what it means too. I'm not trying to change what it literally says. But in the rabbinic, in the old Jewish tradition, in the time of Jesus, like in the Talmud, which comes later, but it's based off of Jewish traditions from the time of Jesus, argues that these cities are cities of atonement. When I say atonement in English, what do you think of?
Yom Kippur.
Yom Kippur. Do you know the Day of Atonement? Happens in the fall, around New Year's. What is the Day of Atonement about?
Getting clean.
But who?
Everyone.
The entire people of Israel, including the high priest. They're all having their sins atoned for. It's like a reboot of your computer, of your soul or whatever. And so...
And also, notice it's unintentional sins also.
Right, unintentional sins. It's because often people will talk about, well, I'm not a sinner. I haven't murdered somebody. I haven't stolen. I haven't, you know, it's kind of a classical argument, well, especially today in the postmodern world.
Yeah.
I'm not really a sinner. I'm just, you know, I have some faults. I have some weaknesses. But, and so this whole argument here is even if you kill someone accidentally, it wasn't your fault. It still has to be atoned for.
Yeah.
And if you think that Yeshua says, even if you murder somebody in your heart or you speak bad words about your neighbor or you wish X was dead, you're actually committing murder. So you need that forgiveness. I mean, the whole understanding of what sin is, or murder is, or adultery is, takes on a whole new.
I think here we ask you a question. First, should we pay attention to the difference of types of these two books? One is Genesis, the other is Numbers, because that will be a big difference.
Yeah.
In Genesis, it says the shedding of blood is necessary. It does not consider any state of mind. But now, in the number, we are considered the state of mind. That intentionally, yes.
Yeah.
But
right.
Externally, not. No. So I'm not
but,
sure.
But follow what you're saying. Follow what you're saying. Numbers, because you're saying it's different than Genesis, right?
Okay.
The context is different, right?
Yeah.
But if you follow the end of Numbers 35, it says even if you killed accidentally, you must stay in that city because you are not safe if you go outside. You must stay there till he dies.
Uh-huh.
So it's still the same concept.
Uh-oh.
Any blood still has to be atoned for.
Okay.
So.
But it does not mean that although you kill someone accidentally, you are still innocent.
Yes, you're guilty of an accident.
Oh, yeah,
guilty of an accident.
Well, even if you don't put it into that language, you have caused somebody to die.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Doesn't matter whether it was accidental or whatever. That person has died, and we're talking about why is blood so important.
So listen to this. Listen to this. This is phenomenal, and. This is, I don't have all the sources here. There's Philo and there's the Talmud and there's something else here. But listen to this sentence. These rabbinical authorities argued that if the perpetrator, the one who had accidentally killed the person, had died before reaching a city of refuge, their body still had to be taken to that city. And if they had died before the high priest had, then their body had to be buried in the city of refuge until the high priest died, and then the body could be taken back to its home. There's still this concept of being covered, this atonement, by that high priest's death. So, anyways.
So his own death did not atone. Okay, we don't know how he died, which we don't. But his own death didn't atone
This is a rabbinical interpretation, right? But yeah, exactly, that they have this concept of atonement. Yeah.
That is very interesting.
So let's just end today with this. Go to the book of Hebrews, because I know everybody's thinking of Hebrews. We all think of Hebrews when we talk about blood and atonement and high priest and Jesus, because that's what... Yeah, how can you not? And so if you go to Hebrews, it's towards the back there.
The New Testament.
Hebrews chapter 4. Okay, Hebrews 4:14. I'm going to start here. Therefore, since we have a great high priest who has ascended into heaven, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold firmly to the faith we profess. For we do not have a high priest who is unable to empathize with our weaknesses, but we have one who has been tempted in every way, just as we are, yet he did not sin. Let us then approach God's throne of grace with confidence, so that we may receive mercy and find grace to help us in our time of need. This starts off the whole idea, the stereotypical thing that we think of with Jesus. When we connect to Hebrews, it starts right here in Hebrews 4:14-16 is what I read. Then go to the next chapter, 5. Every high priest is selected from among the people and is appointed to represent the people in matters related to God, to offer gifts and sacrifices for sins. And so this kind of goes along with what we're reading in Numbers 35, that this high priest is representing this person who killed accidentally with their life. Because if they die, then that person's life is freed by that death. Verse 2, Hebrews 5:2. He is able to deal gently with those who are ignorant and who are going astray, since he himself is subject to weakness. This is why he has to offer sacrifices for his own sins, as well as for the sins of the people. Verse 7. During the days of Jesus' life on earth, he offered up prayers and petitions with fervent cries and tears to the one who could save him from death. And he was heard because of his reverent submission. Son though he was, he learned obedience from what he suffered. And once made perfect, he became the source of eternal salvation for all who obey him. And he was designated by God to be a high priest in the order of Melchizedek. The writer of Hebrews now starts to mix two traditions. There's a tradition in Genesis 14 that talks about a high priest of God called Melchizedek who meets Abraham out on the road. And now he's also mixed it with the high priest that we see here in Numbers 35 and other parts of the Tanakh that are coming together. He's bringing these two ideas together. Then look at Hebrews 6. Hebrews 6, chapter 6, verse 19. We have this hope as an anchor for the soul, firm and secure. It enters the inner sanctuary behind the curtain, where our forerunner Jesus has entered on our behalf. He has become a high priest forever in the order of Melchizedek. Why is Jesus able to be the high priest according to Hebrews, the writer of Hebrews? What gives him qualifications? Is he from the tribe of Levi?
No,
the writer of Hebrews says he is from Judah. He is not technically allowed to be a priest according to what the Bible says. So why is he able to be a high priest according to this writer? What have we read so far? Or God designated him, but why? He was tempted. He was without sin. I think his main argument is he's sinless. He's without sin.
Things he suffered.
Right. He suffered.
And became perfected.
Yeah. Okay. So let's see how he became perfected. Go to Hebrews 7. Hebrews chapter 7.
Before you do that, what was the one you gave me in
6:20. Just one verse there. Hebrews 7, 23. And I'm having to jump here, but there's a lot you can read here. But 7:23. Now, there have been many of those priests since death prevented them from continuing in office. So this is interesting. It makes us think of Numbers 35, right? A high priest has to die. There's continual high priests going through because people die. But because Jesus lives forever, he has a permanent priesthood. Therefore, he is able to save completely those who come to God through him, because he always lives to intercede for them. So this is another qualification I would say they're saying. He rose from the dead. He lives. He's not dead, like, yeah. Right? Verse 26, such a high priest truly meets our need, one who is holy. Okay, so here's other qualifications. Holy, blameless, pure, set apart from sinners. So that goes back to the whole sinless thing. Exalted above the heavens. Unlike the other high priests, he does not need to offer sacrifices day after day, first for his own sins. So we already read that. That was back in what, chapter 4? Verse 28. For the law appoints as high priest men in all their weaknesses, but the oath which came after the law appointed the Son, who has been made perfect forever. Okay, go to the next verse, chapter 8. 8, chapter 1. Now, the main point of what we are saying is this. All right, let's hear the main point. We do have such a high priest who sat down at the right hand of the throne of the majesty in heaven, and who serves in the sanctuary, the true tabernacle set up by the Lord, not by a mere human being.
The right side is more important. Right?
What is?
Right side is more important.
Right, righteousness?
He says it at the right hand.
Right. The right hand, yeah.
Right side is more important than
the right. Yeah, right, correct, and especially in the culture. Go to chapter 9, Hebrews 9. Sorry that I'm going through this so fast. We're running out of time. I just want to come to a final point here. Hebrews 9:11. But when Christ came as high priest of the good things that are now already here, he went through the greater and more perfect tabernacle that is not made with human hands. Verse 12, he did not enter by the means of the blood of goats and calves, but he entered the most holy place once for all by his own blood. Okay, so here we've come. Numbers 35. It's all about the blood. Genesis 4, Genesis 9, blood, Numbers 35, blood, and Hebrews, I think, is coming to his point here, blood. Hebrews 9, 14, Jesus enters by the blood. How much more, then, will the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself unblemished to God, cleanse our consciousness from acts that lead to death? Okay, so here's death. Right? This whole concept of blood and death. Verse 15, for this reason, Christ is a mediator of a new covenant. And by the way, where we have the name for the New Testament today, it comes from Hebrews. This is where it comes from, which actually technically comes from Jeremiah, because Jeremiah is where Hebrews gets it from. But that those who are called may receive the promised eternal inheritance. Now that he has died as a ransom, this is interesting. Because in 35 it said, don't use a ransom to free someone that's killed. But he's died as a ransom. Okay, so it's not money though. It's his death. So it's exactly like Numbers 35. It takes blood to set them free from the sins committed under the first covenant. Okay, now I want to hit this. Verse 16. In the case of a will... You know, a will, when you die and then you pass on your inheritance to people, your children, it is necessary to prove the death of the one who made it, because a will is in force only when somebody has died. So here it is again. Until that person dies, you can't move on to the next part of a program. It never takes effect while the one who has made it is living. This is why even the first covenant was not put into effect without blood. So here we are again. when Moses had proclaimed every command of the law to all the people, what does he say in verse 20? This is the blood of the covenant, which God has commanded you to keep. Verse 22. The law requires that nearly everything be cleansed with blood, and without the shedding of blood, there is no forgiveness. And so it keeps going in here. Let's see. Verse 22. Right, and that comes from Leviticus. Look at this. Verse 24. Christ did not enter a sanctuary made with human hands. He entered heaven itself and now appears for us in God's presence. Nor did he enter heaven to offer himself again and again, the way the high priest enters the most holy place every year with blood that is not his own. Verse 26, I'm halfway through of that verse. But he has appeared once for all at the culmination of the ages to do away with sin by the sacrifice of himself. Just as the people are destined to die once and after that to face judgment, so Christ was sacrificed once to take away the sins of many, and he will appear a second time, not to bear sin, but to bring salvation to those who are waiting for him. And finally, chapter 10. Chapter 10, verse 4. It is impossible for the blood of bulls and goats to take away sins. According to Numbers 35, it takes human blood, right? If human blood has been shed, then it takes human blood to atone for it. Verse 12. When this priest had offered for all time one sacrifice for sins, he's talking about Jesus, he sat down at the right hand of God. Verse 14. For by one sacrifice he has made perfect forever those who are being made holy. Verse 19. And we're going to end with this. Therefore, brothers and sisters, since we have confidence to enter the most holy place, how can we enter? By the blood of Jesus, by a new and living way opened for us through the curtain that is his body. Since we have a great priest over the house of God, it talks about us letting that we can now enter with confidence. We have hope in how we should live. Come down to verse 29. How much more severely do you think someone deserves to be punished who has trampled the Son of God underfoot, who has treated as an unholy thing the blood of the covenant that sanctified them, and who has insulted the Spirit of grace? For we know him who said, "It is mine to avenge, I will repay," and again the Lord will judge his people. Sorry, I just skipped verse 28. Anyone who's rejected the law of Moses died without mercy on the testimony of two or three witnesses. So all of this stuff here to me makes me feel like the writer of Hebrews is thinking of Numbers 35. Because you have the two or three witnesses. You're not, God is not just throwing someone out and judging you based off of a weak testimony. There is strong testimony about our sinfulness that's written in the heavens, which makes me think of Numbers 35, where it says you've got to have more than one witness to say that you committed that murder. And it says, it is mine to avenge, right? This whole concept of the avenger coming to avenge the murder of a family member also gives this idea that God is this avenger for... God is a God of justice. That's kind of what I'm trying to say. That's the bottom line. He wants justice for everyone. And any evil that's ever been done in this world to any person, any child, that the news doesn't report about, one day it will be avenged. And that is a scary thing. If you're a sinner and you don't admit it. Yes.
Yeah, he says the witness is two or three. When
yes.
Should the two? When should the three? Is there any
experience? Oh, difference? I don't know. I'm sure there's been other...
Says
But as far as the legal ramifications of what you're saying, two or three, I think...
At least two, better three.
Yeah, right. The more witnesses, the better. Yeah.
Is that true?
It's not...
We're not talking about the
Yeah, it's interpretation.
No, we are not talking about the secular regulation. I'm talking about the Bible. What does the Bible say?
Right.
Two is enough. Three is better.
Yeah, he's saying at least two.
Yes.
Because you're not one, two or three. So
but,
at least two.
But I would say there's probably some rabbinic interpretations that expand on what you just said, for sure.
Okay.
I just don't know them.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, the good news is the high priest is dead.
And I also say that when you're led by the Holy Spirit and what he told me to do on this pass down before, go Elisheba to the places where they have innocent blood still calling out.
So go to the abortion clinics.
Exactly.
You know,
and you know what? Because it was there, young people, there was nobody there.
Young people.
Huh?
If you say young people, it's a seed of atonement. If you say young people, it's a day of atonement.
Whatever it is. I'm interrupting what my thought is. My thought is that when I went there, there was places open where they were actually doing the murder. Do you know what I mean? I got into places where no one else was there. I said, I'm invisible. The security guard let me go.
We
let them raise it.
We have to give them